Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.
Welcome to this new episode of New Books in Economics. I am Andrea Bernardi, your host of the channel from Oxford Brookes University in the UK. And today I'm here to present a great new book, and I'm here with the author, Martin Konings. The book is titled Capital and Time, and it has just been published in 2018 by Stanford University Press. Hello, Martin. Please, can you introduce yourself and tell us something about your current affiliation and your background?
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. I am currently currently I teach in the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney, where I'm an associate professor. In terms of my background, I am from Holland. I grew up in Holland. I did my undergraduate studies in political economy at the University of Amsterdam. At the time, they had like quite a sort of large group of radical political economists there who, you know, were interested in various aspects of Marxism and Gramscianism. After finishing my undergraduate studies in Amsterdam in 1999, I went to York University in Canada, in Toronto. And that was quite a sort of a conscious choice because I was very interested in sort of Marxist political economy at the time. And that was really one of the preeminent departments in the world. And they had a great number of people like Leo Panitch, who would end up who ended up supervising my thesis. At the same time, you had Ellen Meeksons Wood and a whole bunch of other people who are, you know, who I've learned a lot from. The North American sort of PhD model was very formative in the sense that, like, first you do 2 years of coursework and only then do you start to write your dissertation. That helped me sort of think about a lot of things quite deeply. And the dissertation ended up being about sort of the historical sources and institutional foundations of the American financial system. And the idea was really like, you know, everybody's been predicting that the system would collapse for decades now. But, you know, what is it in the nature of the system that, you know, it runs into crisis, but it doesn't quite collapse? What is that? I was writing this like in 2005, 2006, and then, you know, it was kind of complete. The thesis was complete by the time the financial crisis of 2007, 2008 hit. And so in some sense, that was good timing in the sense that, you know, your research gets a certain degree of topicality. In 2000,
I see that in particular, you ended the book while being visiting at New York University. So you were at the center of where the Occupy movement and the crisis and the protest to the financial crisis was based.
Oh, yeah. Well, this was much later, actually. This was so after I finished my PhD thesis, I went to Holland for 2 years. To work on a postdoc with Ewald Engelen, who is a financial geographer at the university there. And after I'd done that, then I moved to the University of Sydney. in 2009, where I produced a book out of the thesis. So the book out of the thesis was The Development of American Finance, that was published by Cambridge in 2011. And then I did another book on the emotional logic of capitalism. And both these books sort of made the same point that, you know, like, critics of finance are very interested in the contradictions of the system and sort of, you know, how it's all the reasons why it can't function and its weak points. And both of those books were really trying to figure out, like, well, what are the, what is the glue of capitalism? What allows it to hang together and sort of overcome all these challenges, even, you know, despite the fact that it is so obviously problematic in so many ways. And so once I was done with those books, then I embarked on, you know, writing the book that we're now talking about. So, and I wrote that book mostly at New York University. Yes, that's right. So I was there in 2004, 2015, 2016. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So the crisis was over, in particular in the United States, but also the Occupy movement was over. So if I may put a very, very brief summary, the book is about the intrinsic speculative nature of capitalism. Speculation is not just a negative spillover, something that you might want to control as much as possible. So this was very, very topical. What is your opinion about the unsuccessful end of the movements that spread all over the world since the beginning of the crisis of 2007-2008?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's hard to it's a pretty complex thing, of course. Like, I realized that a lot of those movements aren't as active as they were at some point, and that some of them have even died out. But it does seem to me that, you know, Occupy Wall Street has had fairly, you know, significant, it has, you know, a very significant sort of consequences or influence on how we think about things like finance and banks and money. So, you know, like, I can see how people would look at, so just the organizational structures now and be like, well, that's kind of died down. But I'm not so sure. I think it did a lot to sort of get into people's psyches and to really put on the agenda, you know, like, it to kind of provoke a deeper engagement with questions that until then had been dealt with in a very technocratic way. Like, nowadays, everybody knows how to talk about certain things, like, you know, quantitative easing, for instance, in ways that would have been quite unimaginable before the crisis, where you just kind of had this sort of really depoliticized technocratic policymaking. So it's not the kind of change that perhaps has, like, visible impact, but it certainly has sort of very lasting consequences, I think. Well, and also, like, you know, the sorry, go on. Yeah.
No. Well, I wanted to quote something you wrote at page 2, which is, this has turned out to be a serious misreading of the crisis. Instead of a new deal, we got a neoliberalism recharged. Mm-hmm. So the critic didn't work because it was based on wrong assumptions, people were criticizing the wrong stuff, or there are mechanisms of consent within financial capitalism that prevent us to go towards a new paradigm.
Well, I mean, I don't think, you know, I'm under no illusion that, you know, if people sort of picked up my critique, that's, like, politically, that would be a whole different kind of ballgame. And in fact, I would say that what always impressed me about Occupy Wall Street was its sort of creative approach to organizing, but also its sort of creative intellectual contributions and its willingness to sort of think about push beyond that critique, actually, that I take to task in my book. There's even this little book published years ago by Duke University Press. It's called Speculate This. And I believe quite a few people from the Occupy Wall Street movement were sort of involved in producing that. And that's a very creative reflection on, you know, on the nature of speculation that goes well beyond the kind of, you know, theories that I criticize. And yeah, so I wouldn't say it's just a matter of like, well, they had the wrong critique. I think, you know, in the end, there were just more powerful forces out there. You know, there's the resurgence of right-wing populism, you know, the Tea Party's phenomenon, which of course had access to far greater resources, financial media, the radicalization of mainstream conservatism, you know, the democratic establishment that, like, you know, tries to sort of keep the lid on these kinds of things. And yeah, I do think it's very hard to overcome these things, even if you did have the right sort of critique. And also I do feel that, you know, like, even though the movement isn't, you know, perhaps as much there anymore as it used to, but, you know, on the other hand, you know, there is also a certain, you know, alongside sort of the right wing radicalization, there is a left wing radicalization happening. And yeah, I'm not sure that people like, you know, Bernie Sanders or Corbyn in the UK, you know, could have been so successful in transforming the Democratic Party from within if it hadn't been for sort of the energies that Occupy Wall Street had brought to that process. You know, certainly it's done a lot to sort of radicalize the left from within to some extent. And then there again, like, you know, you still have this, all of this is still accompanied by much more profound understanding of, you know, technical financial issues than we were used to. You know, now you have all these debates about, you know, the unaffordability of house prices in large cities. You know, that is not as if they were entirely absent before, but certainly the intensity with which people are getting these issues and sort of, you know, paying attention to them, that is quite new, I think, and, you know, politically very significant.
This is true. I certainly agree. You're right. Perhaps on the financial side, the financial regulation, for example, we are even taking step backwards on that. And in part, we forgot the lesson. But yes, you're right. The movement is not over with respect to other topics. You mentioned your Marxist education and Gramsci. For example, what have you used of Marx, and what you have... you have in which way you've gone even ahead, or you used a different notion of financialization and speculation than Marx's one, for example?
Mm-hmm. That really is quite a hard question, because yeah, like I do have some sort of Marxist credential, but at the same time I'm always sort of under suspicion from, you know, more proper Marxists, I guess, that, like, you know, I've, you know, that's actually not what I do. And I understand that too, actually. That's totally fine. And I don't think there's, you know, that much writing on it. But to a certain extent, I go along with, I think, sort of the core tenets of a Marxist analysis, the way Marx set it out in, like, you know, Capital Volume 1, for instance, where he really sort of, you know, proposes a new way of approaching political economy. But then other parts I'm just less, you know, less interested in, I guess. Like, if you, you know, for instance, like Volumes 2 and 3 of Capital, you know, they're much more concerned with the technical details, and you know, and to a certain extent, you see their kind of Marx getting drawn back into the language and the concerns of, you know, the political economy of his time, quite understandably. But it does mean that, you know, a lot of the theoretical thrust gets kind of blunted, which is, of course, also why many people, like, you know, like Tony Negri, are so interested in the Grundrisse, you know, like, because in some ways it's a much clearer theoretical statement of the philosophical dimensions of that sort of distinctly Marxist approach. And so, yeah, you know, like, well, I'm sure that there will be lots of interesting stuff in Volume 2 and 3. I'm also, it's just not, and you know, people are debating this at length. I'm less interested in those debates, I think, because it is hard to avoid a certain reductive approach to finance, like one that sees it as sort of speculative, unproductive. That is sort of the legacy of that 19th century political economy, which, you know, like has a strong labor theory of value often. So I keep, I've kept a certain distance from these sort of contemporary value theory debates. And when it comes to sort of, you know, working out the more technical detail of, let's say, sort of the basic conception of, like, you know, speculation and the kind of responses it provokes, that I think is sort of in tune with Marx's understanding. But when it comes to working out the details, I found Minsky actually much more helpful, not the Minsky that has become famous through sort of the post-Keynesian reading of him, but more Minsky that is, not the Minsky that is sort of also a critic of speculation as an unproductive practice, but more the Minsky that has been highlighted by people like Perry Mierling, for instance, where it's much more about, the absolute necessity in a capitalist society to take positions on the future and the complex tapestry of debt and payment constraints that emerges as a result of that. And I found that a much more productive way to think about contemporary capitalism than, for instance, going through the sort of, you know, the reproduction schemas and the, you know, questions of circulation and those kinds of things. I think, you know, like to that extent, I've tried to sort of, you know, Marxize Minsky a little bit.
Well, if I can quote you again, on page 3, you say that the orthodox of the past can become today's heterodoxy. Are you thinking about something in particular? And so what is wrong in the academic speculation that makes it difficult to go to the critique of capitalism that you think is necessary?
So I'm just looking at that quote. Like, basically what I'm saying there is that the critique of speculation is very old. You know, it started as the sort of the critique of crematistics in antiquity, and then that was kind of formulated as the sort of, you know, the critique of the idolatrous worship of money in Christianity. And, you know, basically I'm saying that, like, you know, this is not proof as such that there's anything wrong with that theory, but certainly the fact that that kind of orthodoxy, that the orthodox rejection of money, that was in place in the past, that has now become sort of the heterodox critique of the system. It's an uncomfortable reflection. It should be an uncomfortable reflection on the nature of that critique. You know, they've taken some sort of mainstream 15th century Christianity and repurposed it for criticizing the role of finance in contemporary society. That's not proof that it's wrong, but intuitively on every level, I feel that we can probably do better than going back.
You discussed the issue of neutrality of the state and neutrality of the regulators, and in particular with respect to the central banking. So in which way public institutions are reinforcing or contributing to the speculative nature of capitalism?
Massively, I would say. And I think that is really one of the key shifts that neoliberalism has ushered in a way. How to deal with banks and the risk they take has always been a source of worry or a source of anxiety for regulators. All those 19th century British central banking debates revolve around, like, how can you protect the system without creating all kinds of new a moral hazard. That's what, you know, the Bagehot doctrine was kind of an answer to that. Or it was kind of a sort of a first answer to that, which fit with the realities of British capitalism to a certain extent, but much less so, I think, with the American context, which was always much more sort of speculative in nature. And then what you see during, let's say, during the period between the New Deal and the 1970s is that regulators are facing a system that they that is speculative again, that they can't quite control. And every time they do try to control it, you know, like you get these sort of shadow banking dynamics where, you know, like it just goes somewhere else. Every time they do build out an institution, like, you know, just has these, it's, you get the sort of reverse effects. And the shift towards neoliberalism really involves policymakers becoming much more comfortable with the idea of encouraging speculation, because suddenly they think of moral hazard no longer simply as, you know, a problem, but also as something that is quite productive, that, you know, stimulates taking certain risk positions, that keeps the system manageable in certain ways. And you kind of see that in the, you know, the discourse, the way the discourses shift from, you know, like public, from like crisis, from concerns about crisis prevention to crisis containment. So, you know, that they let go of this idea that the crisis is something you can prevent. And they're much more happy to accommodate and even sort of stimulate a certain degree of speculative activity. And that is, of course, accompanied also by the fact that they've learned that it's fine to have a bailout here and there. It's not going to do something horrible. It's just a bailout. Yes, it does have perverse moral hazard implications. But it's not the end of the world. So after 1980, you really sort of see that. And I think, you know, the Volcker shock really played a key role here, because, you know, there was nothing surprising about the immediate effects of the Volcker shock. It was just like, yeah, the whole system sort of, you know, burst out of the institutional parameters of the post New Deal framework. And it was also clear that, you know, there would be, you know, failures of large financial institutions. And so, you know, the whole point, objectively speaking, or whatever Volcker thought he was doing, objectively speaking, was to sort of create a situation where risk could be socialized in more selective ways. Because that was the problem in the 1970s, that, like, you know, they couldn't, there was just kind of this general inflationary trend, because, you know, like, they could only prop up the system as a whole. And now, you know, now that kind of support became much more selective, just targeted at, you know, large corporations, large banks that were about to go under.
This also brings me back to an issue which is very prominent in the title of the book, which is Capital and Time, and also is in chapter 6, which is Time, Investment, and Decision. So what is the, you often have an historical perspective, and in particular, what is the meaning, the role of time in capitalism and in speculative capitalism?
Mm-hmm. The book criticizes the idea of speculation as sort of a deviation from a more solid state of affairs. You know, basically says that, like, any type of valuation is speculative because it's oriented towards the future and you have no guarantees about what you're going to get. So in that sense, it really brings time into the heart of what value and capital are about. Now, to sort of unpack it a little bit more, it's quite common for critical social scientist to criticize orthodox economics for not for neglecting time. They feel that mainstream analysis is too static, not sufficiently concerned with change. And then bringing time in the way that orthodox heterodox critics do, becomes a way to make the analysis more dynamic, more capable of like dealing with change. But I always think that is a limited move. You know, quite often that means that social science becomes a combination of, you know, static and dynamic analysis. So we start out with trying to analyze a world out there that is assumed to exist on its own, independent of time. And then we kind of layer time on top of that as a kind of source of change and variation. So you end up with these essentialist or determinist approaches that really deny their essentialist or determinist. You know, there are quite a few Marxist approaches along those lines. Now, there are other authors, other Marxist authors, like David Harvey, for instance, who place much greater emphasis on sort of the productive character of time. That is not just a superficial process, but, you know, at the heart of how capital works. Capital isn't just something that exists in time, but it is time. It's dynamic. It's restless. It doesn't just exist in history, but it makes history, shapes the future. Now, the key, and I agree with that taken by itself, but it can be quite difficult to make that insight consequential, to, you know, really work it out in ways that show the distinctiveness of a temporal or a temporalizing approach. And what I mean by that is quite common for such approaches to fall back on a combination of, you know, essentialist and dynamic analysis, like, you know, which sort of resembles that Bayes superstructure model. And so, for instance, like in Harvey's case, you know, that's apparent in his take on finance, which he sees as, you know, fictitious, it's irrational, it's a fake presentation of value, speculative in sort of pejorative sense of the word. And this is sort of allied to, you know, fairly essentialist labor theory of value. And the growth of credit and finance are always seen as, you know, manifesting contradictions in the material base of capitalist production. So speculation is always a pathology. And you can see this. So what you get in that way is, you know, it's a fairly essentialist understanding of capitalism. It turns out to be quite difficult to specify how capital doesn't just exist in time, but how it is time. And you see that in other authors too, for instance, like, you know, for the kind of cyclical theory of history, which thinks in like waves of financialization that manifest the contradictions of the material base, like, for instance, like Giovanni Arrighi, his history of capitalism is written along those lines. So the shift that I'm trying to make in my book is to say, like, okay, you know, like, this is clearly difficult. It's clearly difficult to think along those lines. So we really need to just think of capital as at its core speculative, as, you know, value, the value claims of capital, they're forward looking. They are provocations. They need to do something. They need to, you know, like, set in motion the production of the value that they represent. So it becomes an analysis that is really set in time, with sort of time as an active force, rather than something that is kind of layered on top of an otherwise, you know, essentialist analysis to introduce some change and some dynamism.
Very interesting, very complex. Like the entire book, you managed to deal with very complex topics, but in a way which is approachable by everybody. Maybe now I would like to move to a question. I don't know if it is fair to ask, but do you think there are policy implications of your research? So if you were to be named as head of, I don't know, a central bank or a government, would it be possible to deploy your ideas in a practical way?
In a way, yes. In a way, yeah. Okay, let me put it this way. Like, I'm not sure there are too many direct policy implications. You know, and actually, I'm always quite skeptical of strong claims about, you know, possibility for direct policy relevance. So policymakers, I think, occupy a certain position in society at large. You know, and if you make it your job to speak to their concerns very directly and very closely, you know, you inevitably get caught in a trade-off between access and making a difference. You know, you only get these people to listen if you don't challenge their pre-existing ideas and values and, you know, in fundamental ways, in ways that really sort of require them to sort of think differently. And by the same logic, like, you know, I'm not sure that we should be looking to policymakers for to change things, you know, like the people who make it to those positions have gone through a process of socialization and selection, you know, and their job is to make the system, is to keep the system running, not to challenge it. And, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. Like, it's just like, if you're looking for sources of change, I am much more inclined to think about how my work could feed into some of those currents we spoke about earlier, the kind of aftermath of Occupy Wall Street and the way and sort of, you know, a new kind of progressive liberalism is sort of forming around Bernie Sanders and how that is sort of, you know, pushing the democratic mainstream a little bit more to the left. But yeah, like, so that would be sort of my intuitive approach. But if you ask me, like, you know, if somehow I, you know, tomorrow I was picked as the next president of whatever central bank, yeah, you know, like, I could think of a quantitative easing that works much more for regular people than for banks. Like, you know, that is something that people ask for. It's actually like, it's quite a popular theme right now. And it's a very obvious thing to demand in a way that, yeah, people lost their houses, but I mean, people who lost their houses got no protection whatsoever, but the banks did. Like, the unfairness there is so obvious. Anyone can sort of relate to it. So quantitative easing for the people, I think, is, you know, would be something I'd be very happy implementing. I just don't have any illusions that, you know, that this wouldn't be figured out beforehand, or that I wouldn't be immediately booted out if I did that. So, yeah, I think you get my, like, I'm, you know, I'm interested in sort of exploring those ideas, but also somewhat skeptical about how directly impactful these ideas can be.
Of course. By the way, the subtitle of your book is "For a New Critique of Neoliberalism," and given that we discussed about institutions from Europe, I would like to ask you if you see the building of the European institutions, in particular those in charge of the market, money, and regulation, do you think that they are the result of the mainstream neoliberal ideology, or you have a more positive view of the role of the European integration in the process of integration?
So what do you mean by mainstream ideology?
Well, for example, the British left are about to leave the European Union, criticizing, for example, some aspects of the regulation, but they were those that contributed the most to shape it. For example, the idea of market competition applied everywhere, for example, to local authorities, utilities, and public services. So some critique from the left of the European Union is that, after all, those institutions have been shaped by neoliberalism, and so they have to be criticized because they are the result of this dominant ideology. Others have a more sympathetic view of the European Union. I don't know from Australia or from North America, what is the opinion of the European Union project from
I see what you mean now. Like any other, like anything else, like the sort of the grand project of European unification, I'm sure was a very complex mixture of good intentions and people wanting to get control over certain parts of the institutions they were building. And at a certain level, I can still, certainly, you know, when I was growing up in Holland, like, you know, 15 years old or whatever, or perhaps a little later when you're a bit more politically conscious, but it would have been very, very weird for somebody to say that they were against the European Union. That would have been really like, oh, what kind of, you know, what's wrong with you? Like, what are you, like a staunch nationalist? Of course, it's like basic internationalism. So, and I can still appreciate that in a way, that there is that aspect to it. But even if perhaps it wasn't entirely a neoliberal project to begin with, and actually had some pretty noble intentions, yeah, certainly over the past decade or two or even longer, you know, it has become more and more geared to a fairly narrow set of interests that can be pretty ruthless. It's also fairly well documented that there are sort of lots of, you know, neoliberal ideas and think tanks and whatnot behind the sort of the building of the European Union. But certainly, yeah, like the way in which the European Union has evolved over the past decade, seizing on the crisis essentially to impose a draconian austerity regime that has had horrible consequences for some of its economically weakest members. That hasn't left me with any sympathy for the institution. So that, like, you know, there are always these sort of defenders who will never give up defending, like Jürgen Habermas will never lose faith in the European Union. But yeah, I'm not there anymore. Like, I think it's, it needs to be challenged. Not in the name of, you know, the nation state or anything like that, but just as a as an agent of capitalism, as an agent of dramatically growing inequality, and lots of other unsavory things.
Do you have instead? Are you more optimistic about instead China and the possibility that China brings a contribution to a shift in the paradigm, or perhaps not? Perhaps China is already very much embedded in a traditional financial capitalism.
I'm not optimistic about it, but shifts in global power do produce unexpected things. So that way, that, you know, it's not to rule out that things might look up later, but that has nothing to do with sort of, you know, what China is sort of bringing to the table as things stand in a way. But and I also think that this is about geopolitics in part, because I do remember that when I, in 2007, I moved from Toronto to Holland, and I still remember being so bemused that there was this atmosphere in Holland amongst academics and amongst the wider public that, like, there was a lot of schadenfreude, like people looking across, across to America and saying things like, oh, that could never hear. That's just those crazy Americans with the crazy levels of debt. They're risk takers. They just are careless. You know, this will never happen here. And I was like, I don't think this is a very good analysis. And of course, you know, within a year, the whole thing blew over and, you know, the euro crisis became at least as, serious as the American crisis has ever been. Which is just to say that, like, yeah, those sort of dreams that some people have that a social democratic Europe will become like an alternative to the more brutal racism of America. I don't believe that at all. Mm-hmm. I think over a much longer period of time, I do think there will be some sort of rebalancing of geopolitical power relations, but with the rise of China, But what that will look like is, you know, it's just so hard to speculate on. I hope there will be some, you know, like perhaps it will open up some things. But yeah, I don't see, you know, very particular reasons to be super optimistic.
Thank you very much. You've been very patient with my questions, and it was a very interesting conversation. So congratulations for the book.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you. I advise everybody to buy it because it deals with a very complex topic, but it is approachable by everybody in the way it has been written. So this is The Capital and Time for a New Critique of Neoliberal Reason by Martin Konings, and this was published in 2018 by Stanford University Press. Thank you very much.